Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 132 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So, announcements this week. We actually do have a few announcements. I think that the most important announcement, and I think we're the reason I wanted to start off with this one, is that we do have episode titles for the first 7 episodes of season 2.
And remember that Summer will tell you where, it's not a secret, Summer will tell you where you can find these as well, but remember, until something airs,
or they can always change it, for sure. But as it stands now, these are all on IMDb, so it's not like I just pulled them out of my butt. It's cool. All right, so episode 1 of season 2 will be entitled Through a Glass Darkly. Episode 2 is Not in Scotland Anymore. Episode 3, Useful Occupations and Deceptions. Episode 4 will be La Dame Blanche. Episode 5, Untimely Resurrections. Episode 6, Best Laid Schemes. And Episode 7, Faith. We also, there was a question and answer thing that Amazon Video posted that was actually really cute. It was Amazon Video UK, excuse me, that posted it. And it's all posted up online to see, but it was just a cute little Q&A with Sam and Katrina. Of course, Sam and Katrina. They're the only ones people talk to.
Well, yeah, it wasn't Summer and me.
No, it wasn't.
Don't worry about that.
No, it wasn't. And this is as close as you get to a question and answer with me and Ginger. And we also found out that Stephen Cree, and we don't get a lot of news about Stephen Cree, which is why we felt that this was something that was worth noting, is that ScottCon has announced that the first guest for the ScottCon Outlander panel will be Stephen Cree. So ScottCon is scheduled for the 3rd and 4th of September of 2016. It will be held at the Royal Highland Center in Edinburgh. It's a 2-day festival, will be a gargantuan gathering of the clans that will be the first and only festival of its kind in Scotland. ScottCon will allow people to reconnect with their heritage, to indulge in a passion or interest in Scotland, and to educate themselves about all of the wonderful things our country has to offer. And that is straight from their website. So that looks like something that would be fun to do. So if you're going to be in Scotland in the fall, like early September, this might be something you want to check out and maybe get tickets to. And that is announcements for the week.
So this week we have 2 chapters to cover again. I hope you all are enjoying these 2 chapters. They are.
And by the way, it's not just this week. It's a few times a week.
I know.
That sounded kind of bad.
Me or you?
No, a few times a week.
I mean, some people strive for that. Some people are lucky to get once a week.
That's what I mean.
Okay. So, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. You're welcome. So going right onto our read-along. This week we will be discussing chapters 44 and 45. 44, which is entitled, In Which Quite a Lot of Things Gang Ugly.
That's correct.
Which makes me think of Things Go Ugly. I'm sure that's not the direct translation, but
Lisa T. writes, the title itself refers to the 1785 Robert Burns poem, To a Mouse, on turning her up in her nest with the plow. An excerpt stanza from the poem reads, But mousy, thou art no thy lane. Improving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemed, O mice and men, gang aft agley, and leas not but grief and pain from promised joy. Thus, from the title of the chapter, we know that despite Claire's knowledge of the future, things are about to go from bad to worse. I mean, we could stop right there and just say, that's
the
it. that's the whole damn book.
Well, and I mean, we're speeding toward the end here, so.
Holy, holy Hannah.
I mean, hold tight, people.
Oh, yeah. 46 is going to, like, I was telling someone on Twitter today, without giving it away, because maybe you're reading along with us literally as we go, chapter 46 is why this is my favorite book of the series. It's kind of
Not embarrassing. It's kind of morbid, don't get me wrong, but chapter 46 is the reason why this is my favorite book of the series. But we're not going to get there because I don't want to spoil in case someone's reading along with us literally. So back to the chapter. Summer's looking at me like, yeah, let's get back to the chapter.
I didn't know where that was going. I was just...
Well, I can't... That's the thing is, oh, it's so... I'm like leaving it open. It's kind of not even fair to really say that because we can't go with it anywhere until next episode after this one. And as I said on Twitter as well, we will have reinforcements for that episode, which is not just in the form of whiskey or alcohol. We will have people joining us to help us with that major chapter.
Okay.
So Claire has been given up to the English to enable Jamie and the other men who were in that church to escape. In this description of Claire, tired and dirty and cold, sitting before a fire after hours of travel on a horse, to me at least, it's a major flashback to her, quote, rescue from BJR in book one when Dougal et al. Take her after that skirmish. Doesn't that remind you of that?
I mean, it does happen quite all the often.
Well, that's true. It's not just one time.
Either her being taken by one group rather than another, like she's up for grabs, if you will. But they also use her Britishness.
Her Englishness?
Yes. To their advantage whenever. I don't know if possible is the right word, but whenever necessary.
I would say when necessary and convenient. And it is convenient because she's there. Claire's thinking about hygiene. Ever the nurse, one of the corporals brings her some stew, and she learns that they'll be in Tavistock tomorrow. So that was like not really a good segue there, huh? Like just like two little things that
it
weren't
connected.
It
wasn't your best.
Thanks. I was going to go do that again. Oh, that was funny, Summer. Should I just leave it?
Yep.
Okay, so there were a few examples that I was thinking of when I wrote that line. I just didn't include them.
Okay.
But she was thinking about hygiene. I was. I think it had to do with the stew, how kind of gross it was.
Well, it was like...
Well, what?
She made it sound like there was like burnt bits and this was not appetizing and then... Wondering about the hygiene of the person who actually made it as well, mm-hmm. was also a factor.
So she learns that they'll be in Tavistock tomorrow. They've got a tent for her that night, and they tell her, and hopefully they will have an inn the next day, be at an inn the next day. Ever the nurse, still, Claire had gathered some, I hope I'm saying this correctly, charlock? Or charlock, and juniper berries earlier in the day, which she eats along with the stew. She hopes they were, quote, sufficient to ward off scurvy, unquote. So she is always keeping not just hygiene in mind, but also...
Scurvy?
Keeping your teeth, keeping your hair, keeping... Well, mostly your teeth, right? Because that
She's mostly trying to ward off scurvy. I mean, that's what I took from that. She would like to not have scurvy.
That's like, okay, yeah, I can go
with
that.
Let's take it down to its most basis. You're making it all pretty and flowery. And
I'm not making it pretty.
You're making
it
kind of vain and thinking about her teeth and her hair. But
no,
I think that odds are she doesn't want scurvy.
It is. One of the results is that your teeth, you have bleeding gums and your teeth can fall out from what I understand. You can have tooth loss. However, yes, people died of scurvy. So absolutely, it's for nutritional balance and health. But I don't think it's vain to say I don't want to lose my teeth. I don't think Claire's vain. Don't do that to her, girl.
I wasn't. You were.
I was not.
You were.
You were taking it away
from
the teeth.
Like last, you were like, she doesn't want to lose her teeth and her hair, and she likes her skin to glow.
This is what happens when we record at midnight.
She loves lip gloss.
No, I'm just kidding. So Claire had stayed in her swoon as long as she could when Jamie had dropped her.
I think she could have gone a little longer.
Well, you weren't there. You don't know what she went through, girl. But she had to come round once someone was trying to pour brandy down her throat. So she didn't want to drown. So she had to kind of come around. They had brought her to Callender House and given her to General Holly's staff. So this is the place that she and Jamie agreed to meet. She learns that what she thought had been a major battle the night before was actually only a minor skirmish. How disappointing must that have been? It's like, dang, we lost Rupert. We did this. They had to get rid of me. It wasn't even Falkirk.
Yeah. I'd be pretty pissed off. Well, I mean, when you don't have any players in the game... It doesn't seem like it wouldn't matter whether it's a large or a small skirmish, you know. But when you do have skin in the game, it's It means more. And I think with what was lost, it made it almost seem meaningless that
well, exactly.
what they lost.
That's what I mean. Especially when, at least at the point that she was given up so they could escape, when she realizes that wasn't even the battle. And here she had told Jamie, oh, don't worry, the Scots win at Falkirk. Yet here they were almost, you know, had to give her up and just to escape. How's that a win? Well, this is how it was a win, because that wasn't Falkirk. Mm-hmm. So the Falkirk that, the not Falkirk, the non-Falkirk?
The anti-Falkirk?
I want the anti-Falkirk, but the thing that wasn't, I don't know, that's way too wordy, but that's almost like an episode title, the not Falkirk. Okay. So it was only a small skirmish between the Mackenzies and a small detachment of the English troops. The English were even now journeying to meet the expected Highland charge on Falkirk Hill. Now, Clare had thought, as I said, that the last battle had been Falkirk, but no. Lisa T. writes, what follows parallels Clare's experience in Outlander, where she is repeatedly questioned about who she is and what she is doing there. But this time is different. They begin to question her about Jamie, Red Jamie. Because she was found in his company, Clare is being sent south to be questioned further. At this point, her desire to get back to Edinburgh is much the same as her desire to get back to the Stones in Outlander. Clare is handed off to a young private and is to be taken to Kerse. When they arrive in Kerse, man, they go to so many places I could barely seriously keep track. We need a map. When they arrived in Kerse, Colonel Campbell, the person she was supposed to be taken to, was not there. She asks her private, the one she was assigned to, don't get jiggy with it, if she could just get her own lodgings. Now, Diana tells us, quote, I had given the English basically the same story I had given to Colin Mackenzie 2 years earlier, unquote, that she was widowed from Oxford, traveling to visit a relative in Scotland when she'd been abducted by Highland brigands. But her private wouldn't have it.
So they left. Please stop saying her private.
The one who was supposed to watch her. So they left for Livingston. There, she told her story again to a Colonel George MacLeish Campbell, who asks her about the very large Fraser clansman with red hair and the party she was taken by. She admits that, yes, he was part of the party. Now, she's worried Jamie won't find her now that she's been taken to two places after Callender House, where he was supposed to get her. She's told by Colonel Campbell that anyone associated with Red Jamie is to be sent on. Where, we can only guess. Now, she freaks out, understandably. All she knows is that she's headed south. She realizes during her travel with the troops south that they'd assumed that she would have not been unmolested, having spent a night in a church with the Scottish brigands. And Jamie bringing her out in a swoon didn't help her reputation either. A Corporal Rowbotham was a sort of protector for her, placing himself within hearing distance of her each night. Clare being Clare, she decided to attempt a nighttime escape. How is this not unsimilar to Outlander? She tries to escape at night since she is closely guarded by day. So she makes her escape, intending to make it to a village she'd remembered passing 2 hours before they'd stopped that night. She's accosted by a young soldier who wants to give it to her. Quote, it doesn't matter really, does it, sweetheart? What's one more? And I'm an Englishman too, not a filthy Scot, unquote.
Close your eyes and think of England.
Lisa T. writes, this again has parallels to Outlander. When she is first discovered by Dougal's men, and while we all know that Dougal loves to grind corn, he doesn't hold with rape. Her corporal...
But would he hold with coercion? Because that's what that dude was trying to do.
What, Dougal?
No, the other...
Well, I
the,
think
soldier,
that the soldier.
The soldier
would have probably raped her.
No, for sure. But in his brain, he wasn't, because he was trying to talk her into it.
It's like, you've already done it, girl.
Right. And I'm just saying, I wouldn't put past Dougal either.
Oh, Dougal, totally.
I think he would totally do that. And not. Yeah. And while it would still be rape to the person being given it to.
Let me give you this gift on platter. Her corporal comes to her rescue again. This time, once they were back in camp, he places himself 6 feet away from her blanket. They arrived at the inn the next day, but soon were on the road again, this time to Belhurst Manor. As they approach, something about it seems familiar to Clare. She sees part of some coat of arms she thinks she might recognize, and she sees a beggar who also seems familiar,
Quote, I caught a quick glimpse of pale blue eyes as a hunched bundle of rags scuttled into the shadows, unquote. They go into the house and she sees Mary Hawkins. She opens her mouth to speak, Mary does, and Claire screams, a mouse, a mouse! And she ran toward the parlor. In the midst of the chaos she's created, on purpose, she grabs Mary and tells her, don't tell anyone who I am. Mary gives her understanding. Mary tells her father that the commotion was just caused by a mouse. The baronet, Mary's father, says after reading the letter of introduction accompanying Claire, quote, it seems his grace is to be your host, at least temporarily. Remember who's been referred to as his grace throughout the story.
I mean, there's a few.
I mean, there's no bishops here. So bishops are referred to as your grace. But other than that, I think it's just dukes.
Are you sure?
I think so.
I can Google that.
Lisa T. writes, I love the mouse references in this scene as it ties in perfectly with the title. Claire is about to be turned up from her nest, she's using Beecham as her name, by a plow, otherwise known as the Duke of Sandringham, who knows exactly who she is. As someone comes to take Claire to see his grace, Mary is stuttering after her down the hall. As she's taken into the room, she sees the crest she'd partially recognized outside. It's Le Duc. She and the Duke converse. She buys time by telling him his hospitality is lacking. He orders refreshments. They take tea together. Claire hears banging across the house like a hammering. Yes, Summer.
All right. It says, his grace, or her grace, is a style used for various high-ranking personages. It was the style used to address the kings of England until Henry VIII and the king or queen of Scots up until the Act of Union of 1707, which merged the Kingdom of Scotland with the Kingdom of England.
Okay.
Today, the style is used referring to non-royal dukes and duchesses and archbishops in the United Kingdom. But that's today. I'm just saying, I think other people have also been called his or her grace.
Other things you gave of the kings of the kings of the Scots and the kings of England were not at the time period of this, of the mid 18th century. So I guess we don't have a 100% answer, but I'm pretty sure the two things that I know, it's for dukes and duchesses. And four bishops. And I guess archbishops, too, would qualify. So as the Duke begins his questioning...
As the Duke.
I didn't say that.
That's what it sounded like. So as the Duke...
As the Duke begins his questioning, he tells Claire, quote, I must say, Mrs. Fraser, you are amazingly difficult to kill, unquote. She's shocked, but tells him, I have no idea what you're talking about. He replies, don't you? A man comes in when the Duke rings a bell. It's the man who'd tried to kill Claire in the alley in Paris. She recognizes him by the beauty mark on his thumb.
I mean, how close were they in this room? I mean, did he walk in and be like, look at my thumb? I mean, that it would have been one thing if he hadn't been wearing a mask during the time of the attack and he walked in. She's like, I know that face. But like, I mean, did he walk in with his thumb like, hey, thumbs up, check it out?
She didn't even know the thumb. She just knew the mole.
Right, but does she automatically check thumbs of every person that walks into the room ever from
she
here on out?
She must have been really affected.
By his thumb? Was it huge?
No, by the event that, or scarred, that now she does look at thumbs, yes. It's funny.
Was this a huge mole? I mean, and how far? I mean, how it seemed like they were across the room.
I think he came in to stand. I don't know how close they were, but not that far. She's not going to see like at the doorway. Come on now.
I'm just saying. I thought it was a little far-fetched that she would have recognized from across the room.
It was a little convenient. Speaking of convenient.
I mean, so if he walked in and like offered his hand and like walked right up to her, I could see that being like, I see your hand. It's now in my face. And now I recognize your beauty mark.
She recognizes him by his beauty mark on his thumb. At this, Claire pulls a Teresa from The Real Housewives of New Jersey and flips the tea table.
I don't watch that show.
Oh, Ginger does. Ginger likes The Real. I have nothing against any of those shows, but the only two that I've seen and never missed one ding dong episode is The Real Housewives of New Jersey, which is the most real of them all. And I think the most entertaining.
Why is that the most real of them all? I don't watch any of them, but
well, then you
as a non-watcher, how can you state unequivocally
it
that
is
this
the most,
is the realest?
Not real like the others are fake. It's the most real like down and dirty.
And then other than that, my favorite is The Real Housewives of New York City.
You judge the realness based on how many fights they get into?
Basically, you don't want to mess with The Real Housewives of New Jersey. That's all. New York is very entertaining, but New Jersey is like, oh my gosh. But yeah, it's cool. So if anybody else likes that, yeah, let me know. At least let Ginger know, because she likes to watch it. Them.
I was like, careful.
What?
What do you like to watch?
The shows.
Mm-hmm. You like to watch them get down?
Summer.
They're the realist, I hear.
So the dude who had tried to kill her with his peeps in the alley in Paris was the Duke's valet.
That almost didn't sound right.
Le Duc says that in addition to all of the names she's calling him, he's also unlucky. The men he'd sent to take care of Claire that night in the alley had freaked out because of Claire after deciding she was a witch. But before they ran away entirely, they decided to have some fun with his goddaughter. Now, he's definitely not happy about that because... But he didn't seem hurt. He didn't seem upset by the fact that it was her virginity that was taken or that her reputation was ruined. He seemed upset that, oh, man, I worked so hard to get this marriage for her. Now, that's totally ruined.
But that makes sense for the time period, though.
I get it. But it was more, oh, man, you ruined my plans, rather than, oh, my poor goddaughter, she's off. She feels so awful now. You know what I'm saying?
I know,
but I don't think he cares.
I don't think he cares at all either. I think that he feels that he's wasted time.
That's what I mean.
He's wasted time and
Le Duc et le Dick.
Please don't make that the title of the chapter.
I love it. I don't know.
Nope.
That thing I told you almost 3 years ago gets to come out right now.
Well, not right now.
No,
it's
but
later.
Soon. Oh my God. I've been holding this so on to this for so long.
I'm pretty sure we sang it at some point.
Ever. I mean,
on the show.
But not with the words. We kept that. Well, we're going to pull it out a little bit later.
That should be the title.
We're going to pull that a little bit later? No.
No, the other.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes. Okay.
Sorry. Calm yourself. Okay.
Claire is having shock after shock. She faces one of them.
Pick one.
I was about to say, she must have been facing a shock because I don't know what I wrote. She asks the Duke, quote, "Do you mean to say you actually tried to have me killed?" Unquote. The Duke answers, "Well, yes. That was the point I was endeavoring to make. Tell me, my dear, would you care for a cup of sherry?"
No.
Diana,
he's like, well, it seemed
awesome.
Easier. I mean, I didn't really want to kill, you know, Hot Jamie.
Did want to kill Hot Jamie.
Well, I know, but he said it would be easier to kill Hot Jamie. He could derail the whole thing that they were trying to do.
If he could just get him to get his attention away from stuff.
Exactly.
So Claire knows enough to know she'll take something. Brandy, lots of it. The Duke then quotes BJR, quote, "Randall said you were the most diverting woman," unquote. Claire's suspicion is confirmed. "He does work for you." The Duke replied, "Of course. Often the best tool is the most dangerous," unquote. Can we just pause for a moment?
We can.
Okay, that was good. So the Duke assures her he knows more than enough about BJR, likely more than her. To her question about blackmail, the Duke says that while used against him, it might restrict him from being welcomed into certain circles of society, it would likely be a death sentence to Randall. And of course, we're speaking of homosexuality, or at least the involvement of a certain nature between males.
You just took a real big breath before that. Like, you were like stealing yourself to say all of that. You were like, homosexuality and blah, 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 blah. It was a real big breath.
I did not realize this.
You're like, I'm not going to get this all out if I have to take a big breath.
Because we know, I always have to put this out there, and Summer does too, whenever we have this discussion of BJR and his so-called homosexuality, we know that BJR isn't homosexual per se, but an equal opportunity sadist. So if you say someone who has any kind of encounter with someone of the same sex is a homosexual, that's not necessarily the definition of homosexual, correct?
No, it is not. However, I think that for the purpose of the Duke,
100%.
But for the purpose of this novel
and for the time,
yeah, that's the
enough.
More shocking of the things because
of course, because it's a dude,
exactly,
or they're dudes.
Well, because I mean, Because, I mean, it wasn't frowned upon to beat your wife. And it wasn't frowned upon to, you know, hit your kids. So, I mean, it's like that element of it. Now, granted, he's takes it way overboard. I'm definitely not trying to make anything he says be an okay thing. But, I'm not condoning beating your wife or your kids. I'm just stating that in that time period, it was a lot more acceptable socially to beat your wife and kids than it would be to be a homosexual. So he was really, you know, batting a thousand there.
The Duke says that it isn't money nor the threat of exposure that binds Randall to him. Quote, he serves me because I can give him what he desires, unquote. He says it's not being with men. Rather, it's punishment. Quote, but you know that, don't you? Or at least your husband does, unquote.
So is this the implication?
Oh, snap.
No, but wait. But is it the implication that...
That he knows?
He wants to... But I almost... It almost sounded like he also wants to receive the punishment. Not just met it out.
Oh, BJR?
Because he was like, I can get him what he needs, the punishment.
That's a good question. We've never seen BJR in that light.
Right.
He gets off on causing.
Exactly. Pain. So I don't... But it was like kind of the way that the sentence was worded, and I don't know if I was reading it that he was going to the Duke to get punished, or if it was the Duke made available to him the ways in which he could punish others, which both work. Both I could see being feasible. I don't know. I don't see the Duke as somebody who would
I don't think the Duke means literally he does it. I mean, he makes him make sure he connects him. Exactly. Okay. He either like finds a safe house or gives him money to pay to someone to let him do stuff to. I don't know. There's all kinds of ways. Basically, he knows that if he does the Duke's bidding, the Duke will enable him to do certain things or at the very least keep his secret safe. And that is, in a way, not permission, but allows him to continue if he can. Maybe the Duke has a safe house under his place. I don't know. But in some way, the Duke facilitates that. And he pays him for his job. But the biggest thing is it's keeping his secret. We don't know how much he helps facilitate. Again, does he bring in women? Does he bring in men? Are they kidnapped? Are they paid? We don't know.
It sounds like a little Marquis de Sade in high enough posts that he can get away with what he needs to get away with.
The Duke?
No. The Duke helps Randall be in a high enough post.
Yeah.
That is enough to cover.
Mm-hmm. It had also been Le Duc who'd sent the seaman who'd attacked. That's the word.
I know. It's so
who'd
bad.
Sent the seaman who'd attacked Jamie in Paris. The Duke says he'd wanted to get rid of him because they'd been attempting to thwart, quote, a particular affair in which I had interested myself, unquote. So does he mean the restoration? Well, that's discussed coming up. But then Dougal had turned up in Paris. Then the Duke had wondered just where Jamie's interests lay, wondering if he was in fact working for the Stuarts. Now, going through and reading this, and I think finally by the end and I was writing things out and I read through it a few times, I think I got it clear because I understand what Diana's trying to say, but there are so many things. And again, as Claire says, real life history is still unclear about the Duke and about what side or what he was really truly doing. One of my notes was, this is almost more confusing than time travel talk. Because it was, I mean, maybe not, but I can't get my brain around this. So Claire at this point is wondering if he was a secret Jacobite. Sandringham then says, once it became clear to him what Jamie was trying to do, he tried to lure him back to Scotland by getting him that pardon. And he says it was all for nothing. And then he remembered Jamie's devotion to her, his wife, and thought the loss of his wife would distract him. Claire, looking around, again, how close was she to that dude to see his mole or beauty mark? And how close is she to the piano to know that it's that piece of stinking music? I mean, that's got to be like, really got to be close to see this writing because she was able to read it.
Well, she doesn't need spectacles. So maybe that's has superhuman vision as well.
Dude. She sees a piece of music on the harpsichord and realizes it was the piece of music that she deciphered with Mother Hildegard. With the help of Gerstmann, right? There, I mean, there were a few people involved. It wasn't just Hildegard.
It's so crazy how now she's like magically musical, like crazy musical. Like
Claire?
Apparently, because I read music a little bit. I'm not a great sight reader. I don't know that if somebody had sheet music across the room next. No, if somebody had sheet music on the piano in front of my face that had no lyrics or anything else that's identifying features on it, that I would look at it and go, oh, it's that one piece of music that I listened to that one time
at months ago.
I mean, the odds. I mean, apparently she doesn't do enough with music that maybe it left that much of an impression.
That's the only one that she remembers ever.
Right. But I was just like, the odds of being able to have that kind of recall without any other kind of marker is crazy.
So Claire grabs a vase and shoves her face into its flowers. She does this to hide her face because in the green velvet drapes, she'd seen, quote, a round, leathery object shaped like a pumpkin, unquote. She looks again, and this time through the flowers, she knows that she sees the face of Hugh Monroe. It had, I know, stop it.
This is a rough couple chapters, people.
Yeah. It had been the beggar at the gate that she had recognized. She was right. He was outside the window looking in at her, perched on, I'm guessing, some ledge outside, it appears, among the ivy outside the window.
Could be the first floor.
That's true.
Could just be peeking in.
That would be a lot easier for someone, for anybody.
Lisa Especially T. a pumpkin-headed beggar.
Lisa T. writes, Claire has gone from prisoner to Jamie Bate. Things are definitely gang aft eggly.
She's always been Jamie Bate.
That's true. Claire's just bait, period. Claire does have a ray of hope. During the questioning by the Duke, Claire sees Hugh Monroe, Jamie's friend, out the window. She knows that Hugh will get word to Jamie. Meanwhile, the Duke is trying to figure out who had helped her with the music deciphering. Hugh signs some basic signs to Claire while she's looking out the window, and something about them leaving and running away together, and then he leaves. The Duke says he isn't exactly a Jacobite, quote, not necessarily, unquote. So to me, he seems uncommitted either way. She tried to recall what Frank had said about the Duke. History had been uncertain regarding his being a Jacobite. Now, we won't find out now. He has her taken to her room, one that he'd had altered. Remember that all that hammering? He'd had all this, all the wood hammered to cover the windows and had the door reinforced or something. It was pretty ludicrous. So her prison, though it was a prison, was pretty luxurious. She tried to remain calm and think things through. Hugh was there. He would get Jamie to her. Hugh knew everything about every place. All this, of course, if he'd made it down from the Duke's walls. So he was at least up a little bit. Her windows had been covered with wooden bars. She could barely see out. But what she did see, and it was after dark, was two or three figures appearing from the stables bearing lit torches. There were also shouts coming from the park, trees in the park, as well as from the stables. The small figures ran toward the wood. There was also a tumble of people in front of the house. She could see that a fight had broken out, and it was all over or about one man. He was overcome by the Duke's men, this one man was, and then carried back to the back of the house. She could tell from the shape of him that it wasn't Jamie. She did see, however, one of the stable lads following after the party with a leather wallet, and she could see that it had metal ornaments shining in the torchlight. It was Hugh and Rose coins and gaberlunzies. They'd captured Hugh. She goes crazy, screaming, crying, pounding on the door, breaks a pane of glass to try and get anyone's attention, but to no avail. Later that night, she awakes to Mary Hawkins opening the door. Mary had bribed the housekeeper to let her in for the night. Claire asks her if she'd heard the racket outside earlier. Mary hadn't. But she did hear that they'd caught a poacher in the woods. Claire said it was her friend who was going to tell Jamie where she was. She asked if she knew what had happened to him. And Mary has to tell her the bad news, that they'd hanged him already. Claire's in shock, going through grief, fear, etc. After she's able to come to herself a little bit, she asks Mary what she's doing there. The Duke thinks he has another husband for her, we find out. It was a Mr. Isaacson, an importer of London. She'd not told Alex. Mary really didn't have any choice but to marry Mr. Isaacson. Claire continues to wonder about Sandringham. He'd been willing to murder to make sure Charles had the backing to go to Scotland. She figures he could be a Jacobite, willing to have a Catholic king in return for future benefits as a backer of a restored monarchy. Or conversely, if he could help assure Charles came to Scotland, fought on, and ended up losing, how much more generous would the Hanovers or the English crown be for helping bring Charles to the English? Kind of like the old fox, playing both sides.
He's playing more than both sides.
The next morning, Claire wakes up to the sound of something heavy landing on the bed, striking her and trying to murder Mary. Jamie was on top of Mary. He obviously had gotten the wrong woman. Jamie tells them to get up, get dressed quickly, and he leads them out the door. He'd come to rescue at least Claire. Mary says she's going with them, and Jamie says, yeah, no. But she threatens to scream down the house, and with some prodding from Claire, Jamie agrees to take her along with them. They come across a maid who is looking for her lover, a man named Albert, and Claire realizes that this is the Duke's valet, the man with the thumb mole. Apparently, she's waiting for him to meet her. They were having a tryst. Then they hear another person coming. It's Albert. Oh, so basically they scared the maid away. Claire was able to kind of shame her and say, you know, what are you doing here or whatever? And the woman was like, don't tell on me. I don't want to lose my job. And so she went back to her room or she left. Then they hear the second person. And this is Albert, the one who the woman was waiting for. Jamie is quick to get him up against the wall. He slices his throat with his knife. You can't use the gun, yo. And seeing this, Mary vomits. Now, I said that all very quickly. Basically, Claire identifies the man, right? Mm-hmm. And Jamie
tells him the only reason he's dying quickly is because he doesn't have time.
He's like, look, I got to get out of here. This is going to be happen.
He's like, you're
quick.
You're not getting the death you deserve.
But
you're going
to
die.
I want you to see her to be the last thing you see before you leave the earth. So after Jamie does it, they have to get out of there. Claire hurries them out of the hall. Jamie leads them away and they make their way outdoors. Murtagh was looking for Hugh. She has to break the news to Jamie about the hanging. Murtagh then appears, holding a cloth-wrapped bundle under his arm. It appears to have a blotch of dark blood. Now, since he's got, like, a string of sausages around his neck and a ham under his other arm, she's thinking, oh, it's surely something recently butchered or whatever from the kitchens, because that's where Murtagh has just come from. Before they ride away, though, they're sure to get Hugh's body to take home. Jamie tells Claire all about how he'd gotten into her room, how he got the keys. It's hilarious. All the stuff he goes through. He goes to the housekeeper who says no, and she's just, he has to gag her. He ties her up with the.
Well, no. And then he finally says, you know, if this whole thing that I'm doing now doesn't work out for me, I'm not going to take, you know, attacker of women as a profession because, you know,
it's too much work.
They're brutal.
I know. Yeah, that exactly. So they arrive at Hugh Munro's house. Jamie takes his body into his wife. Murtagh and Mary join them a few minutes later. Murtagh lays a saddlebag on the ground before them, then tells Claire, Mary, and Hugh's widow, I bring you your vengeance, lady, and justice for the wrong done to you. Unquote. Hugh's widow knelt and drew out the head of the Duke of Sandringham.
See, well,
the first time I read this, it was a huge shocker. Huge shocker.
It's like the end.
You're like, where did you find time to do this?
It's like the end of Seven.
I haven't seen that movie. Is there a head in a box?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, like, I got to give it since I just gave it up. Okay, we got to do it real quick.
But it's not in a box. It'll be in a bag.
I know, but it's too cute. I mean, it's too perfect. So, I mean, what? The 90s, right? 90s? Or early 2000s? Early 2000s?
It was the
SNL Scott. Not Scott.
It was one of the first big digital shorts.
Oh, my gosh. Andy it was Sandberg Justin and Timberlake. Justin Timberlake. And Andy Samberg. And, of course, did they actually sing that word?
Yeah.
Okay.
They bleeped it.
They bleeped it. I don't sing this, but they had a few little riffs, right? A few like versions of this. One was a pizza box. One was a gift box. So Adam Sandberg, Andy Sandberg, and Justin Timberlake did this short on SNL.
They looked like Color Me Bad.
Yes. like the color suits, like the bright blue suits with the thin and like tie.
The beards and the like yes. close crop beards yes. and the sunglasses.
And they would be, they walked into a room or they on stage or whatever, and they had a gift box, like with the bow on it and everything, like holding it in front of themselves. So they would be singing different lines versus whatever, but it all came back to something like, oh, so anyway, so they were holding this.
They were talking box. About guys who don't know what to get their girls for.
There you go.
For
there you go.
Christmas or Hanukkah, whatever.
But they came up with the perfect gift.
It's the perfect gift.
And they would hold this little gift box. They were just holding it, like entering a room, hold it just in front of them. And then they like let their hands go and then the box would stay. But the whole thing was called da 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 dick in a box. And so that was years ago. And I don't think I thought about this back then. It was just before or no, but just after we started the podcast and I'm like, I don't know how it hit me or what I thought about it. I was like, oh my gosh, this is too funny. Well, that short came back to me and this scene with his head coming out of a bag, not a box.
That would be my Duke in a bag.
But that I thought of, it's a Duke in a box because it's not Dick in a box. It just, I've been sitting on that for almost at least 2.5 years. And I don't know why it makes me so happy or so makes me, it just makes me laugh so much. So that is where this episode title, it has to be Duke in a box.
Okay. Well, Duke in a bag.
Sorry. No, it has to be Duke in a box.
He's not in a box.
It doesn't matter.
It does matter.
It doesn't matter.
Trust me, if we don't make it Duke in a bag, people are going to be like, but it's not a box.
Well, then you listen to the show and you find out where it came from, don't you? Just like, anyway. Just like Dunnut Brown has nothing to do with anybody's
sounds like poop town.
Nastiness.
Okay, it does. But anyway, what I was trying to say is that at the end of Seven,
oh, sorry, back to this. This
FedEx delivery guy shows up or whatever delivery service shows up and delivers this box. And it's like, he delivers it like to the middle of nowhere and like, I don't know, a couple hundred yards off one direction is Brad Pitt's character. And then, like, I don't know, half a mile the other direction is Morgan Freeman's character. And they're all on cell phones. And you see, like, a helicopter overhead. And they deliver this box. And on the phone, the convicted or the serial killer is telling them, you know, I'm the final whatever. And it's, you know, there's the box is for David. And it's David. And David is Brad Pitt's character. And he's across the field. And he's, like, he's got... I think he's got the murder. He's got the serial killer in front of him. The serial killer's talking to Morgan. It's so convoluted. Anyway, he's standing there.
It sounds like it.
And, or did they deliver they delivered the box. Oh, that's what happened. They delivered the box to Morgan Freeman's character. So Morgan Freeman's character has the box. They diverted the box. And he's telling Brad Pitt that the box was a present basically for him and that he's, you know, because it was a seven deadly sins killer. So he's fulfilling his seven deadly sins serial killing spree by being the last of the seven deadly sins. And I totally just spoiled Seven for you if you haven't seen it. I apologize. However, but his sin, I think, was envy or whatever. And he was trying to tell Brad Pitt that he was envious of this person. And so Brad Pitt's on the phone with Morgan Freeman. And Morgan Freeman has got the box open. And Brad Pitt's character just is like, what's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? And it ends up being his wife's head.
Oh, Lord.
In the box. So every time we get to the bag scene, I'm always like, what's in the bag? What's in the bag? The Duke's head.
So that can be a compound title. What's in the bag? A Duke in a box.
No. What's in the box?
A Duke in a bag?
That would be more accurate.
No.
The Duke in a box. The Duke is not in a box.
It's a play.
He will never be in a box.
D in a box, Summer.
He will never, ever be in a box. He was delivered in a bag, and I promise you they're not going to put his head back with his body and put
it's
it in a box.
It's a play on the song from Saturday Night Live. Come on now.
It's wrong, though.
Just like Dunnut Brown, girl.
Please stop saying that.
So, Lisa T. writes, on a side note, Hugh Monroe is very symbolic in this chapter as well. As it was he that gave Claire the gift of a dragonfly in amber as a wedding gift. With his sad demise, we are reminded of his wedding gift and what the symbolic ramifications will be.
So that was chapter 44. And now we'll be moving on to chapter 45, entitled Damn All Randalls.
So they travel north, having to hide all the while. They have no way of knowing where the army was, so they decided to go to Edinburgh. When they get there, Jamie goes to the army headquarters and Mary and Claire go to see Alex. Alex is mesmerized when he sees Mary. Claire goes outside to give them some time alone. When she returns, she examines him, and he sees on her face that he does not have much longer. He says, quote, "I waited. I hoped she would come once more. I shall die in peace now," unquote. OMG, this scene. It brought tears to my eyes just reading it. If they do this right, which I know they will because they do everything else right, I mean, namely this actor, right? Oh, man. Alex tells the already mourning Mary, quote, "We have known it for a long time, my love. Don't despair. I will be with you always, watching you, loving you. Don't cry, my dearest," unquote. Claire notices that Mary is simply blooming.
Blooming.
Lisa T. writes, "I still wonder how Alex and BJR can be brothers. Alex is such a love." Alex asks Claire to come the next day with Jamie, and she promises they'll come. They go the next day, and Mary is still with Alex. The latter tells Jamie that it's his presence only that's needed, and that they're waiting for one other person. The door opens. Jack Randall comes in. He sees them all, and then Jamie, and he freezes. But Jamie turns toward the bed, which is where Randall rushes to. As the brothers talk, it all clicks for Claire. Mary is pregnant. And she says as much out loud, quote, "It isn't money. She's with child. I think he wants you to marry her," unquote. And that is what he wants. Alex would marry them, his lover and his brother, with Jamie and Claire as witnesses. After the ceremony, Jamie tells Claire to stay with Mary and Alex while he escorts Randall to his quarters. Lisa T. writes, "I found this passage fascinating that Jamie would actually escort BJR to his quarters. I think it demonstrates Jamie's sense of honor and BJR's impotence. He has no power over Jamie, and Jamie is in no way threatened by him. But still, after everything he suffered at BJR's hands, it was an uncomfortable read."
I think that he also had no intention of allowing him to be alone with Mary Hawkins. I don't care if he's
really?
Now.
I never thought about that.
I don't care if they're now technically married. I don't think he trusts him alone with anybody. And to go back to a few seconds ago when you were talking about BJR being so different from his brother and how those two people could have come from this, you know.
Same family.
Yeah.
Same parents.
I think the only redeeming quality about BJR is his love for his brother.
Yeah. That night in the inn together, we learn that Alex indeed had not lasted much longer. Lisa T. writes, "They retire to their rooms, and Claire points out the obvious fact. Well, I said, attempting a smile, at least we know Frank is safe after all," unquote. Lisa writes, "I really wanted to smack her one for saying that. It was quite insensitive." Now, Diana writes, after this, that Jamie glowered down at Claire, ruddy brows nearly touching each other. He says, "Damn Frank, damn all Randalls, damn Jack Randall and damn Mary Hawkins Randall and damn Alex Randall, or God rest his soul, I mean," he amended hastily, crossing himself, which, by the way, includes his wife. She's a Randall. Mm. He makes his point that he will not share her with anyone, even a memory, as long as they both are alive. Lisa T. continues, "It has cost Jamie dearly to allow Frank to exist. First, it prevented him from exacting vengeance on BJR. It cost him Faith's life, time in the Bastille, Claire sleeping with the king to free him from the Bastille, and on from there. But now Frank's existence is assured." Lisa T. then writes, "Claire asks Jamie to take her to bed. I am not sure, but perhaps Brianna is conceived at this point." So they make love almost like getting to know each other again, or slowly, to remember each other. Later, he tells her to go to sleep so he can speak things to her that sound daft when she's awake, but in her dreams, she'll hear him and know the truth of it. Lisa T. again writes, "The chapter ends with one of my favorite passages. Diana is a master of these moments." And I wrote, "It's one of my favorites too, Lisa." Quote, "I woke in the night, still in his arms, and knew he was not asleep. Go back to sleep, Madunya." His voice was soft, low, and soothing, but with a catch that made me reach up to feel the wetness on his cheeks. "What is it, love?" I whispered. "Jamie, I do love you." "I know it," he said quietly. "I do know it, my own. Let me tell you in your sleep how much I love you. For there's no so much I can be saying to you while you wake, but the same poor words again and again. While you sleep in my arms, I can say things to you that would be daft and silly waking, and your dreams will know the truth of them. Go back to sleep, Madunya." I turned my head, enough that my lips brushed the base of his throat, where his pulse beat slow beneath the small three-cornered scar. Then I laid my head upon his chest and gave my dreams up to his keeping. Unquote. Finally, Lisa T. writes, "Even though Jamie and Claire are on a collision course with Culloden, for now there is a moment of peace after so much heartbreak."
And that was chapter 45. It's literally all downhill from here, people.
Oh, Lord. Downhill as in quick and downhill as in not so hot. And basically chapter 45.
Why pick one? Can't we just, you know, take them all?
I said that.
Okay. Didn't sound like it.
What? The rest of them?
It sounded like it was an or.
Oh, I thought you meant which chapters. So 44 is the shizzle with Claire getting not abducted, but being given away. And then, of course, losing Hugh. And 45.
I'll never lose Hugh.
And 45 is, of course, we lose Alex. But we find out the truth about Frank's parentage, finally. And so, yeah, chapter 46. Kind of crazy, not fun. But again, the reason that this is my favorite book.
Are you going to be able to, you know, read your notes handle back? It?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Like I said, we have reinforcements. So
you would never cry over the Skype?
Over the Skype. Have I actually ever cried during an episode? I've had like...
I'm pretty sure we've had moments where you were like...
Like a sniffle or something? Like maybe a small sniffle. I don't think so. I mean, I think I'm good.
We'll see. We should take bets.
No.
We'll see what the odds are in Vegas.
No. In Vegas. No.
See what the bookies
you
are
saying. You want to take odds in Vegas, you...
Don't let you touch the dice.
No. That too. No. You announce season 3 stars. We start our Voyager read along this summer. Hello. Did you know that?
Don't start with me.
I'm sorry. But when we do Voyager, and I think it's like halfway through or whatever, because we can't say what happens, that one scene in Voyager that everyone is like everyone's favorite scene, that I probably will get a little bit verklempt on. This is awful. That is happy, but I think much, too much. That one I could definitely see getting a little teary. But I think that's good for now. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
That my young love